So good morning, all. It's so good to see kids, some activities for kids back. Just to backfill the details there, y'all, we have not been negligent or lazy. We're trying to be cautious and safe. And so I know you appreciate that. But we've been slow to bring back kids and slow to bring back youth because I'm not going to make Monday calls around some super spreader event that we, you know, we couldn't wait to celebrate together. So we're just going to be cautious there. And we listen closely to what's going on. We listen closely to healthcare professionals in our area, probably a little more attuned than we'd listen to politicians, and that's been, we're gonna listen to beds at our local hospitals. And so if you're a parent and you're anxious for that to happen, it will happen. Help us make that happen by doing what we can do. So welcome all, good morning to all of you. It's good to see your faces again. So last week we began what will end up being, I think, a little short mini-series. I love mini-series, it's my favorite TV, is the mini-series. I can't do 17 seasons. I'm trying. I love the BBC miniseries where there's 6 episodes and you're done. That crime is solved, y'all. On to the next thing, right? 17 seasons of Grey's Anatomy might be the hardest thing I've ever tried to do for a child. But one of my kids, it's very important that I fully understand McSteamy and McDreamy and all those things. And so I'm going to try to do it for you, baby, but we'll see in the end. But anyway, last week we began what's going to end up turning out to be a little miniseries in the book of James, which, as you know, isn't a book at all. It's a letter. And being a letter, we can only assume that it was written to remind and to redirect actual communities of faith, which is why it matters for us. And in this case, it was written by someone named James to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, scattered throughout the ancient world. And I'm always thinking several layers when I'm thinking about the Bible. You know, what did it mean then? What does it mean for us? Why would these people have written? And so why do we read these letters that were written almost 23,530 moons ago? I did the math on that because it felt fun. That's AD 62, if you must know, if some of you can't calculate that in your mind. I'm sure everyone calculated that in their mind. 23,538 moons or something like that. But why do we read these things that were written so long ago? And most importantly, why do we assume, almost blindly at times, that they were written to us personally? I'll bet you guys can find America in the New Testament. It's not actually there, but I bet you can find it. I bet you can go back to the words you were told where it was, right? But why do we do this? Why do we assume it's written to us? Is that even a natural thing to do of ancient correspondence between different parties? Who taught us to do that? I'm going to tug at every thread in the sweater until we get some play here so that we can critically think about these things. Did you ever think about this? Here's a thought. The way we read our ancient text has as much to do with how deeply, how desperately we crave being told exactly what to do as it does with how divine inspiration actually works. I'm going to read that again in case you missed it. The way we read our text has as much to do with how deeply, how desperately we crave being told exactly what to do as it does with how divine inspiration actually works. Did you ever think about that? If we can find someone, y'all, something, if we can find anything to tell us exactly what to do, then we don't have to take risks, do we? And best of all, we don't have to listen to ourselves, which of course is the most dangerous and yet most rewarding risk of all. Anyway, my goal is that we learn to read our text as adults, not as children. Which means reading it like people who can listen for resonance and harmony with what our bodies are also telling us, with what our guts know to be trustworthy and true, with what science and discovery and wisdom and history and research and reason confirm as true and trustworthy. We don't read it alone as if it's the only thing that speaks. We put it in harmony with other things we know. Anyway, we have lots of letters like this one preserved in our tradition. And as I have said before, these letters were written specifically to remind and redirect. These were laundry lists of contradictions, of disappointing behaviors in the view of the apostles, of hypocrisies and oversights and failures. That's why these guys sat down to write these letters, to correct communities of faith. I've always chuckled when people say to me that they want to be a New Testament church. Really? You want to be a gathering of folks who get so sideways so quickly after being started that the founders have to send handwritten letters back with mutual friends to straighten you out, to clarify, to fix all the stuff you're getting wrong? Is that really what you want to be? Is that who you want to be? Not me, no thanks. I'm willing to settle for who we are, who we are now. Imperfect, yes, but curious, growing slowly, but growing up together, not unlike those communities of faith. Anyway, to reset the table here before as we move forward in James, he opens his letter with this shocking idea. All trials are to be seen as occasions for joy. Because of where they take us, because of how they hollow us out, how they whittle us down. If you need more on this, go back to last week's podcast or Facebook Live. It's about how they prepare us for what's coming next, because wisdom and good living require us to move towards one another. And James will identify that as the source of joy. James writes, anything that moves us in the direction of wisdom and maturity can be, should be, is to be embraced as a gift from God, perfect in its purpose, good in terms of its eventual goal. That's what James writes. And I'm not sure if you had time to reflect on this idea last week, but this idea has sat in my mind like a tiny acorn. It's a simple thing. It's super small. But if you plant it and if you let it grow and if you feed it, it contains 1,000 great oaks. It contains 1,000 forests, at least in its potential form. This is the kind of thought that can upend your life, embrace all things as a formational journey forward. This can undo us entirely, at least if we let it. It's been working on me this week in the following way. Here's the thought. Nothing is wasted, y'all. It never is. The cosmos is a completely closed loop. Everything stays in the mix. Everything ends up recycled, which is true about cells, but it's also true about learning and growth and human development. Meaning, as I look back at my life, I'm sure the same is true for you, and what has happened to me, the calamities that I have survived, everything has taught me something. Not one moment has been wasted. It's all redeemable, all of it. Not just the accomplishments and the triumphs, but also maybe especially the defeats and the losses and the setbacks. Our friend Rob Bell says it this way, everything is my teacher, which is just his redistillation of truth that surfaces actually everywhere, most especially in Eastern philosophy. And if this is true, which I think that it is, then all things come from God, because all things work themselves into the mash. That is, if wisdom and maturity and growth is the goal. So when Paul writes to his friends gathered in the city of Rome, when he writes these words, all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purposes, he's really just stating the obvious, y'all. He's just saying what's true. He's just naming how the cosmos actually works. You see, the same is true for James the Just, or James the Greater, or James the Lesser. And again, if you need to know the controversy over who penned the letter, go back to last week. But the same is true for James. When he writes that everything that comes from God is perfect and is good, these are just ways of saying that there is an end point to all of this, a divine trajectory, a purpose. To make this goodness, this purpose, exclusive to whatever subgroup of humanity you like the best would be a mistake. As James will clarify, all things, meaning all, are being pulled towards love, are being pulled towards God. Now, you can call this the consummation, you can call this apocalypse, or simply refer to this as redemption. Any of these ideas work. It just becomes a question of what language you prefer, or what language and symbols the tribe that shaped you happen to have preferred. Just know this. Paul and James and Peter and John all name how things actually work, and that's why we still read their letters. The big idea here in James chapter 1 and James chapter 2 turns up everywhere people are actually listening, in every culture of every time. And it's this simple idea, all is God and God is all. Accepting this truth positions you to understand the sequence by which you will become mature, lacking nothing, as James will say. And eventually, if you live long enough, or if you just resist hard enough long enough, this becomes a lens for making sense of the past and making sense of the future. Single word attempts at this might be release or surrender, I love that word, or trust, or falling, or maybe free falling, or maybe faith, or wisdom, or completion, or maybe integration. All of these concepts describe, even if only in part, what we're moving towards. It's all good. And it all comes from God if we can accept it. With that foundation, let's push deeper into James, shall we? Now, James begins by addressing the inner world in chapter 1. As you know, he says, turn inside, all things come from God. But he doesn't stay there, lest we think that spirituality is entirely internal. It is internal, but it isn't only internal, and this is where I will argue with the premise of Western civilization. In fact, whatever exists only on the inside, only between you and God, James will go on to question altogether. And this is what gets him in big trouble with some of the church fathers a few centuries later. So let's read James chapter 2. We'll pick up in verse 14. James writes, "What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith but do not have works? Can faith save you? If a brother or a sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you goes to them and says, 'Go in peace, keep warm and eat your fill,' and yet you do not supply their bodily needs, what is the good of that? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead," says James. And just a few verses before this, he writes it this way in chapter 1, verse 27. "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to care for the orphans and the widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world," writes James. Notice, if you can, if you are brave enough, the centrality of the body in determining real faith. Notice how something we often think of as intensely private and intensely personal matter, what we believe and how we carry out our devotion, look at it again, it demands external action, according to James. That unspoken private internal attitude has a natural and axiomatic connection to the outside world, specifically to the poor among us. And this will turn out to be very important. I might paraphrase this and say it this way. Pure internal postures of worship and devotion, pure intentions that bring pleasure to God will always show up in the real world as willful and conscious self-emptying on behalf of those who will never repay you, at least not in kind. I know that's not a very good summary if it takes more words to say it than the way James said it, but that's how I would translate that passage. You see, the poor are one thing, friends, but this language, widow and orphan, is very important. It refers to those who will likely never be able to return the favor. This isn't an investment in someone who will repay you someday. Oh, we have values for those things. That's called interest. This isn't about paying it forward. This isn't a hand up or a loan. This is a loss that James identifies here. And this, says James, must accompany inner devotion, or it doesn't qualify as pure religion. It's dead, says James. Dead for us is one thing, but dead for an ancient Jewish mind is a whole nother thing. Dead as in unclean, don't touch, don't go near, says James. It's dead. Apparently, James, whichever James is writing here, didn't read a ton of Paul's letters, or he didn't make much of them if he did. You see, Paul invests everything in faith and faith alone. You know that word formulation. In Ephesians 2, Paul writes this, "You are saved by faith alone, not by works, lest anyone should boast, lest you should get braggy." It's faith alone, says Paul. Faith is the mechanism of action, faith alone. No need for works, according to Paul. James says no action, no faith, simple as that. Paul says faith alone, nothing else to add. Well, friends, which is it? In time, certain parts of the church would go on to speak clearly on this. Theologians in the 16th century would call this doctrine sola fide. You know it in Latin, which means only faith. And I just say that to be super condescending, translating Latin for you. That's right. I said the 16th century. Remember that one? The century that saw unprecedented global expansion through violent conquest, all in the name of a particular version of Christianity that gave itself a pass on action, a pass on justice, a pass on looking out for the plight of the disempowered. Since faith was entirely an inside job in the 16th century, according to the ones who also believed that God had preordained them to sit on top of the heap, action didn't matter. How and who paid for it wasn't of consequence. What would James the Just have said about such a version of faith? Faith alone? Really? That's like saying internal belief alone, even without action in the world, justifies. The simple fact is this. James will have none of this. He seems crystal clear to me. There is either a physical, observable result in the world, or it isn't pure religion, it isn't faith, it isn't real. Worse yet, it's dead. James isn't compelled by disembodied belief, and neither should we be. Now, it's impossible to prove to you exactly who wrote this letter, But for the sake of argument, I'll go with the great weight of Christian tradition. I'm willing to concede that it was probably James the Just, the younger brother of Jesus. He's most likely the author of most of these ideas, even if this work was finished after he had passed. It makes sense to me, and here's why. The opening is at least a little bizarre if you look at it closely and compare it to other opening letters in the New Testament. He writes simply, "Hey, James here." That's it. No other details to back that up. Nothing else needed. Maybe he was so prominently featured in the imagination of the first century due to his blood connection to Jesus that he just needed to say this, "Hey, James here." Kind of like saying, "Goodbye, it's Madonna here," or "Pele," or "Rihanna," or "Oprah," or "Ronaldo," or "Messi," you fill in the gaps, all of these people being on a one-name basis with the planet. Here's my point. James was a big dog in the early church. His opinion mattered. He was, after all, blood relation to the Son of God, which, of course, so are you and so am I, but it would take the church centuries to figure that out. James was important. He was connected. You see, we think Paul was the unrivaled theologian of the early church. We think he was. That's how we look at history. And we're not prepared, for the most part, to tug on his thinking or question his doctrinal contributions and formulations. But allow me to remind you that there was a time when Paul was thought to be rogue by Peter, and if by Peter, then certainly by James the Just, the honorable vicar of the church at Jerusalem. Paul's ideas were way outside, and hang on, this is going to get a little funny if you've been reading mostly Reformed theology your whole life. Paul's ideas were way outside the mainstream of many of the first followers of Jesus. I hope you know that. These were followers who were Jews with no regard for the Gentiles. In fact, there was little consensus around Christian doctrines in the beginning, which is funny because there still isn't. Ironically, Christian zealots have always waged wars against one another for believing different things on these highly precise doctrines. And reading James on his own without dissolving James into Paul, frankly, is the most honest way to read a text like this. It validates a space for variation on thinking. It affirms the evolution of thought. What I'm trying to say is this. James the Just would have written these ideas about faith and action and pure religion while at the same time that Paul was thinking through similar ideas in other places, coming up with different formulations like faith alone. And which formula will remain? Faith without action is dead, or faith alone saves? Whatever you do, don't let the brevity of this short little epistle throw you off. I know Paul was more prolific. We have most of his writings preserved. But James was the ideological titan in the early game. He would have been the Toto Wolff of his day, not the Mattia Binotto. And that's a reference for Jay Friels and my daughter Taylor and maybe Wade and Drew and Jeremy. The rest of you don't know Formula One. That means nothing. James was the titan in the early part of this game. Anyway, Paul would rise to pole position in time, pushing James back to row two, but not immediately. That would take several centuries. There was no straight line to disembodied faith, to an entirely internal affair from the teachings of Jesus. It wasn't a natural leap. The poor mattered most before they didn't. Don't ever forget that. James says, no action, no faith. Easy math, simple equation. How could someone be okay or justified before God on the inside while still complicit in evil systems of oppression on the outside? This was inconceivable before it wasn't, before Christianity lost her way. Faith was simple to James. That's why I love this book, this letter. How one treats one's neighbors is the mirror image of what they believe. No division, no separation. One single expression, which is a timely reminder to us. If you're telling yourself this preacher done lost his mind arguing with Paul and pitting Paul and James against each other, I wonder, have I? I wonder. Do you want to be where contemplation and action mix as a single movement in the world? Do you want to be a part of something where internal ideas become bodily actions in your neighborhood? Oh, I do. There is no more division between the seen and the unseen realm, friends. It's all an expression of a single flow outward towards others, towards the cosmos from the life of God. It's all sacred now. Dualisms and binaries of all kinds have fallen apart. They've collapsed from the inside. Spirit and flesh as discrete realities no longer make sense. Friends, you know this is true. You know this is true. If you believe in the incarnation of God and the man, Jesus Christ, then you've already learned how to call flesh divine. You've already learned how to call earth heaven. You've already learned that Jesus, the man, flowed seamlessly across these two domains of existence, blending them together forever. You know this to be true. The same domains that you and I were taught were exclusive, if not contradictory, altogether. Jesus wove them into one new thing. Actually, they're not just exclusive and contradictory in the way we were taught to think about spirit and flesh. It's worse. We were taught one is good and one is bad, that spirit is good and flesh is evil. Thanks, Paul, for that idea too. This kind of thinking actually would go on to be condemned later in the church as heresy. Too bad we still live by it today. The domains have been collapsed into one reality, friends. The lines between heaven and hell have all been blurred. Contemplation and action, belief and justice, faith and how we treat the widow and the orphan are points on the same line now, on the same continuum. Who would have known this better than James, the kid brother of Jesus? We cannot live in open contradiction between what we say we believe and how we live, friends, whispers to us James the Just from many years ago. You see, dissonance of this kind isn't an inconvenience or an insufficiently precise doctrine. It's evidence that real faith is not yet alive in us. How many of you can look at decades of your life and say, it was all religion and no real faith? Oof. We live exactly what we believe. We live exactly how we think. Doesn't matter what we say we believe, what we actually do, how we actually conduct ourselves and live is what we actually believe. Don't forget, James' actual concern was how his readers treated the poor and the disadvantaged when they came into the community. Go back and read it in your own free time. It's an interesting conversation about how they received the wealthy and they marginalized those who didn't look so wealthy. James is trying to rescue pure religion from the domain of belief alone, from the headspace alone, and he's trying to tether it back to action, to the body, to the poor, in a good world. In chapter 2, James mentions something he calls the royal law, which is code for this familiar formula, and you know it, love your neighbor as yourself. Meaning, with the same level of love and concern, with the same level of nurture and care. Folks, the assumption here is that I am my neighbor and my neighbor is me. This is what James is describing. To love myself is to love my neighbor. There's no more distinction. We are the same now. And some of us get stuck right here. We can't move any further because our love for ourselves is so poor, so anemic, so inconsistent that if we love those around us as we love ourselves, they're doomed to untold cruelty and contempt because that's how we treat ourselves. Maybe some of you need to stop right there and begin by learning how to love yourself if you're to love your neighbor that way. So, what do we have here, friends? What's on the heart of the good vicar in the holy city of Jerusalem? Maturity, which implies growth, which assumes testing over time and attention to the sequence and embracing the process. Progress, or the lack thereof, that's what motivates James to write. Remember, letters are written to address real situations. The joy that results in the movement towards one another specifically. You might call it integration. And if your mind is inserting the word discipleship here, it's because you're a good post-evangelical trying to recover. That's what we called this. Any movement we called discipleship, right? That's what our generation called it, and I hate that word. Words wear out like tires on cars or like sails on ships. They need to be replaced in time. They will no longer take us where we need to go if we wear them out. And the word discipleship is blistered and thin, in my opinion, but the concept isn't. I prefer the word integration or becoming one across the domains of existence and reality, increasingly living in the intersection of belief and action to drop an anchor back in the metaphors of James. I think that's what he's writing for. The evangelical church murdered the word discipleship for me. Discipleship basically meant two things growing up, getting our belief and our behavior straight. And I use that word straight as intentionally as I use the words behavior and belief. And you know what I'm talking about. We'll talk more about that soon. There's a lot of really good progressive thought around how to recover the idea of discipleship in churches like ours. We'll get to that eventually. For now, just know that integration is so much bigger than getting your beliefs precise and your behavior in full compliance with whoever the white guy in front tells you you should become. What if we looked at how we actually live? Now hear me. Instead of how how many people we have sitting in classrooms learning about the Bible or traditional views on marriage and sexuality? What if we observed how we treat the widow and the orphan, for example, or how we treat people that we don't like for good reason? What if that was the measure? What if action was the measure of faith? What if total life integration was the goal? Well, it certainly seems to be in the case of James the Just. This final thought today. You might be thinking, oh yeah, you're talking about knowing something by its fruit. Not exactly. Judging something implies an understanding of intention and heart purpose, and we ought to know better. Something we don't have access to is understanding that intention. You see, judging something by its fruit is how some people end up turning a blind eye to bad character and oppressive systems because they're growing and thriving. Fruit is tricky, y'all. If you don't believe me, go and listen to the podcast, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. How many of you have listened? I'm watching you guys bobbing your head. If you have nothing to do for the next 42 days, it's a long one. It takes almost a whole drive from here to Chicago. Take my word on it. But it is interesting to see how we make space for things that thrive simply because they grow, but they're bereft of character. There's no action. Yeah. Fruit, as it turns out, friends, is largely in the eye of the beholder. Remember that time when the disciples, in response to Jesus' teaching on the wheat and tares, told him they'd be happy to tear out the weeds sown by the evil one? Remember that story? Some think it's the central parable of Jesus' teaching. Remember what Jesus told them? He says, you actually have no idea which is which, so save the damage to all and leave both weeds and wheat alone. We're not great at reading fruit, are we? But here's what we might do. And with this, I'm ready to close. How about we evaluate a belief by looking closely at who wins and who loses? Who gets hurt and who suffers? Where does the power flow as a result of our belief? What if we looked for the downstream damage to determine how pure and good our faith actually is? Oh, I think that might take us somewhere we need to go. Martin Luther was disgusted by the letter of James, but Martin Luther King Jr. loved it. He quoted it often. I'll bet you can guess why. Now listen, it might sound condescending to offer you this permission. You don't need my permission to believe or unbelieve anything, and yet I will offer it for those who need to hear me say this morning. Focus less on belief, y'all. Focus more on life integration, on life transformation, on things that actually work in the world, and how those around you experience the faith you say you have. Focus on that. We've made way too much of our private belief. Faith has always been a public affair, says James. I wonder if you'd pray with me as the musicians gather. Join me on your feet if you are able to do that. And let's pray. Father God, we bring to you our doubt this morning, and our struggle, and our worry, and the gap between the things we say we are about and the way we live in the world, and we bring them to you and we say, integrate us today. That is our prayer. In your name we pray. Amen.